This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Sam Doncaster. How are you, Sam?
Good, thanks, Chris. Good to be here.
Excellent. Later on today, you're going to be showing me and some of my work colleagues here some of the new Piwi wines. What does Piwi stand for? I know it's German.
It is German, and it is an abbreviation of one of those long, complicated German words, which includes the initial term Pilsner. Pilsner is fungus, and you get Steinpils, which is, you know, great for cooking because you go into the forest and find them, and they taste really good. But you get all the other fungus that grow on your vines, and things start to rot. That is not so good. The WI bit can just be translated as withstanding. So if you have something which withstands the pressures of fungus, it is tolerant or resistant.
Yeah.
So that's what PV is an abbreviation for, resistance to fungal infections.
You call it PV, I've heard it as PWI.
Yeah, well, PV, PWI. Yeah, that's German for you.
Okay. All right. And you've got an interest in this, these new breeds, because your nursery produces some of these grape varieties, don't they?
Yes. We work with a range of ones that have been fairly recently, I'm going to say fairly recently, like the last sort of 15, 25 years in Europe. You know, there's ones from government research stations, of private individuals, and even sort of across borders and boundaries with other people. So we have ones which have been selected for cool climate, and particularly for me, there lies a point of interest. Cool climate, we're moving more and more into places like Scandinavia and as well as the UK. Mm-hmm. Big market in places like the Netherlands. UK has a lot of good sparkling wine production. It also carries a good potential in still wine production when we have a little more experience in growing them here.
Okay, well, let's talk about genetics as a general overview of the industry.
Yes.
Because I think you were saying earlier that before phylloxera and the arrival of molds and mildews, because someone told me, I don't know if this is true, you can correct me if you know, but my understanding was that they accidentally brought phylloxera over, which is a louse that caused all sorts of problems, and then it was at a Wine GB conference yesterday, and someone mentioned this, and then they said that the reason we've got molds and mildews is because they brought that over by trying to deal with phylloxera. Does that make sense to you?
Sadly, it makes complete sense.
Yeah.
You know, this whole kind of moving any life form from one continent to another, not so bad just across, you know, country's border within a big island, but essentially one big island to another, you just carry the worst problems with you because there is no natural sort of systems that
resistance, yeah.
Yeah, to hold them back.
So For people that aren't quite aware of it, one of the big problems in a lot of vineyards is things like molds and mildew, powdery mildew, downy mildew, grey rot or botrytis, depending on where you're at, that type of thing. And though Vitis vinifera, the grape variety that we use for Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Chardonnays, all that sort of thing, is a European grape variety. And there was no molds and mildews in Europe, but in America, there was loads of molds and mildews. And my understanding is that the vines in America grew up with molds and mildews, just like it grew up with phylloxera, and they developed natural resistances to those. And when those molds, which are just mold spores, they're tiny, they can jump on a plane and they'll be there without any worries. When they arrived over in Europe, Vitis vinifera had no defense for it.
Yes, that's true. And with no defense for it, it just goes right through a whole continent on the winds. I mean, how quickly can it go from one side of a country to another on a wind that is traveling at quite some speed? This is not exclusive a problem for vinifera. We see it with roses. Mm-hmm. We also, every single year, without any shadow of a doubt, find that all of the cucumbers, the courgette, zucchini, they all get this sort of thing. You can't stop it. You can't even spray for it, really. You can hold it back a tiny little bit, but it's going to come and it's going to wipe out anything.
Okay, and did it all come from the Americas, or were there molds and mildews in Europe beforehand?
Well, I think there would have been.
Yeah.
And there are some other things that you haven't mentioned as well, but like Phomopsis and black spot and sort of things like that, where the stem starts splitting open in springtime and things. There's no life form that doesn't have something that wants to eat it.
Yeah, true. Okay, so these molds and mildews came over. A lot of people early on were using copper sulfate because they found that was an active
yes.
way of killing molds and mildews. But there's been, in recent times, part of the experimentation with genetics, right through from the 1930s really, isn't it, have been trying to look at, well, some of these American vines are resistant to it. Can we cross Vitis vinifera with some of these American vines to try and get some sort of that resistance going?
Well, there's some truth in what you say, but it's actually a little more complex and it's a little older than that.
Mm-hmm.
If I can ask you to consider, Europeans went from Europe to America
mm-hmm.
and they took with them the things that they love, including the European grapevine. They got to America and, of course, it didn't grow very well. But some sharp-minded people started to think, what would happen if we made some crossings?
Oh, in America?
Yeah. So they were doing these crossings in America a long time before the pest problems came to Europe.
Okay.
And they had a compromise with what they had with terms of quality and that sort of thing, but they could make a wine and they were happy with it. Later, when those infections came, phylloxera as well as fungal infections, you know, were in Europe, someone thought we should go to America and ask them how they find a way of living with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back with the right answers. So they had to learn how to do all this kind of rootstock growing and grafting.
Was that from America, was it, the rootstock
yeah.
grafting? They discovered that as trying to grow Vitis vinifera in America.
Yeah, the two go hand in hand. There's still, in some areas of Europe, pockets of these hybrids are still there. And until quite recently, there's some quite large quantities of it. And yeah, I mean, strangely enough, they're all the same kind of family, really, the rootstocks and these sort of hybrid things, sort of. So people had to learn what they could do with different plants.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about copper sulfate. Now, obviously, chemistry, the knowledge of chemistry, it's like 100 and whatever, 20 years ago, is not what it is today.
No.
And neither were the mechanics of applying it. We have tractors with very sophisticated trailers, tanks, mixers, agitators, you know, all the chemicals that do all the things we want to do. They never had anything like that. They were just doing things like with a hand pump and a, you know, a wand.
Yeah.
And having a horse pulling a trailer up the field or something. It was just, you know. So the mechanics of the whole thing has changed quite considerably. The use of grafting for the purpose of phylloxera,
and nemetodes.
Yeah, and nemetodes, yes.
Yeah, nemetodes.
Yeah. It's not really a big issue where I come from, but never mind. And then the spraying, the mechanics of it.
Yep.
Yeah, complex and quite interesting. So the genetic was always there before, you say, the breeders, you know, maybe in the 30s. There were residual amount of these old vines in different parts of Europe. And strangely, actually, some of them even got into New Zealand very early on and they got lost. Nobody knows where they are. In places like Martinborough. But there's one or two individuals particularly have gone out looking for these old varieties and started crossing them over and moved into where we are today. They are massively complex now. And also an understanding of how the genetic works is much better clearly understood.
I see. So just to recap, so in America, they were doing crossings.
Yes.
Some of those crossings came over to Europe a lot, you know, before the 1930s or whatever,
yeah.
and were being grown in different places, people trying different things.
Yeah, 1860 or something.
1860, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, very early. And then in the 19, because I always think of it starting in the 1930s, really. I don't know if that's, because you look at a lot of these modern breeds and they always go crossed in 1930s in Germany or in Jura.
Well, that's after a lot of work had already been done.
Yes, yes. Okay. And that, what they were doing was they were taking vines that were hybrid, that had some sort of resistance. And then they were taking those plants and then recrossing them to try and create something new that still maintained that resistance.
Yes, and there's, I mean, a lot of this work was in a terms of like Austro-Hungarian Empire days, and this work was done before the First World War. You know, these things are in Hungary. Mm-hmm. People started doing things in France and then took it out of France, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think lots been actually was done in Germany at that time, but yeah, there's still a lot of interest in table grape, hybrid table grapes in places like the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. They're still breeding sort of table grapes there.
Okay. I suppose the reason that hybrids were never very popular is people often describe them as not tasting very nice.
Sadly, there is a reduction in quality, and also they're just different and people don't like a change.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing to recognise, because we can now say we've bred out of that. We're moving very, very much into vinifera characteristics. Mm. I have been fortunate enough to attend tastings with some of the most recent released varieties, and there are knowledgeable people in the room who don't know what we're tasting and have no idea it's not vinifera.
Yeah.
And yet I can say those vines have never, ever been sprayed.
Okay. All right. So we'll see where we're at. We're going to move forward in time, I think. That's the way to do it. So we're up to the 19. We've done sort of 1860s. These crossings are here. People have gone out, found these old vines and started crossing them again.
Yes.
The vines that turned up in the 1860s into Europe at that stage, I presume they turned up because they had some sort of immunity to molds, mildews, or was rootstock common at that point, so you didn't need to worry about, you just do grafting, so you didn't need to try and create a crossing that was resistant to phylloxera or nematodes?
I think they're all kind of slightly related, and so people doing one works doing the other works as well.
People nowadays, no one's selecting hybrids on their resistance to phylloxera.
No, you get the
rootstock you want, and then you put your cyan on top now. Yeah,
I think they've now got so much vinifera in them that they wouldn't be resistant
to phylloxera.
Yes.
Yeah, unless it was selected early on all the way through, which it hasn't been. No, certainly
any of the rootstocks which have a little bit of vinifera in it are not allowed in some countries in Europe. They just say no, do not ever use this.
Okay.
Because the tiny bit of vinifera will allow phylloxera to get started. It'll then get stronger, and then it'll just chomp its way straight into the plant.
Okay. All right. So that, yeah. All right. So they're not even like that. So
yeah.
Rootstocks, and then those initial crossings. You know, do you think they were like first generation crossings in the 1860s? You know, Vitis vinifera.
Multi-generational quite quickly. There's a whole lot of varieties like Leon Mio, and Lucy Kuhlmann. Don't know who Lucy Kuhlmann was. There are quite a lot of German names in this. People still use these varieties in Switzerland and Austria and Alpine countries. And they're some of the sort of, these are 40, 50 years before Regent, and Rondos and things like that. And I now look at those as being ancient history. Mm. Because people breed every year. They learn very quickly what the attributes of a plant is, and they're breeding all the time.
Yep.
As a tiny side, I will say that I've seen on several occasions quite large numbers of seedlings put out in a field and grown, and I've been part of the selecting team where you walk down and you're looking for a clean plant. Like one plant in maybe 20 has got clean leaves.
You mean no molds or mildews?
Yeah, all the others have got, even though they come from a known background of sound genetic crossings, they still get infected.
Yep.
So it's a very small proportion which will have clean leaves. And you can tag these with a little bit of tape and they get lifted out and get replanted. Next year you do the same thing. And so very quickly you hardly get anything left, because all the ones that get mildew infections are just rejected.
Yep.
Then you have to grow that up to the point where you can get grapes off it and see if they taste good.
Yep.
Incredible amount of work. I mean, 40 to 60,000 of seeds, of which you're going to end up with sort of like 300 plants.
Really, yeah. Okay, and those plants, you know that they know that the thing about crossing sexual reproduction is
yes.
every time you do sexual reproduction, you get something different. It's like your parents.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Every time they get jiggy, they get a yeah. brother or a sister, and no two brothers. They might be similar, but they're not the same.
Yes, true.
And so you that's the issue, is when you're doing that sexual reproduction.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're getting that sort of issue coming through.
So what we're doing, you know, you can take these vine flowers have got both male and female characteristics. So you can get to the point where you can just physically take the cap off the flower, take off all the male anthers, it's only female, then get a flower from another plant and shake the pollen all over it and put a bag over it with a little twisty tie so no other pollen gets into it. And you can say, all the seeds that come from inside that paper bag are gonna be from these two plants.
Mm-hmm. But each seed is slightly different.
Every seed is different. And I mean, maybe each grape has got more than one seed, maybe three or four, perhaps. So when we harvest that bag, you've then got to wait till the grapes are just begin to rot a little bit and then wash them and break them off and get the pips out and put them in a fridge to give them an artificial winter. And then you can say they're ready for doing some work. But I mean, you can end up with, say, 200 seeds. So when these get planted out in a long line in a field,
yeah.
they are all from exactly the same parent. But everyone's got a different characteristic.
Yeah. You go through, you choose the ones that you think have got, is it just mold and mildew? You're looking at it. Does anybody do any DNA testing on these plants before selection?
No. That finances dictate that's impractical.
And is that because just a volume?
Yeah, you go through like, a couple of years of just fungal infection on the leaves. Then you've got the vines, you think these ones might have some potential. You can then look at the records and see what they should have. And you might choose to do a little bit of DNA sort of testing to have a look to see if they've got various genetic markers that mm-hmm. have gone through.
And people are aware of those genetic markers for mold and mildew or whatever it is.
They are now. But that's actually relatively recent. I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, they certainly weren't.
Mm.
And people, it's more complex every year as people are going through it.
Yeah. So you're not doing it on every seed because it's just too much work.
No, it's also faster in a way to actually see what is happening in the field. It's a slightly tricky area to talk about because other things might be at play and it's not always easy to see. For example, you can say, I've tested for this. It's free of all of that. This is a plant which is going to be robust. It's going to be resistant to all known fungal infections. But what you haven't tested for is the rogue gene, which upsets the activities of those other genes. And then suddenly you grow it up to this height and it gets covered in mildew. Why is that when it still carries all of the right genes?
Yeah.
It's what you haven't tested for that's important.
As well.
So field trials in conjunction with testing is critical.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when they're looking for things like powdery mildew, for example, resistance, yeah. Are they just looking for one gene or two genes or is it a combination? You know, and is there different mechanisms? Because I'm aware of... for example, some rootstocks with phylloxera, they release some gummy things that blocks up the mouth of the phylloxera, and others have other resistance to it. There's different ways things can be resistant.
I don't know how the resistance works with fungal infections. Mm-hmm. The level of kind of workings that I work with is we've got this, you're a nursery person, you know, bulk it up. But we talk in terms of a lot of the commercial releases that are producing wines now have only got a single layer of resistance running through it. And
so there's one defensive line,
One defensive line. And you know, when the fungal infection goes through its own multiplication, there could be a mutation and that could work, find a way through that resistance. Mm. So the smart money now is looking at producing vines with multiple layers of resistance in it. We're just at that point where we're beginning to see quite a few coming through. The next question very critical question is, what do they taste like?
Mm.
So in terms of, you know, things like money for testing in the first place, I mean, someone's got to grow all these things up, do micro vinifications. Time is money, but I mean, I'm talking several years at least, but you've got to have someone who does all the right work to be able to make a small amount.
And the problem with micro vinification is the wines do taste different if they're made in a small, small, small batch compared to a, you know, 2,000 litre tank versus a 50 litre tank as well. So you might get an indication, but it's not necessarily going to give you the confidence I would have thought.
Experience can teach you which ones are likely.
Yeah.
There are some flavours you think, that's a shocker. Yeah. And you think, I won't take it any further because it'll always be there.
Yeah.
And there's other ones you can sort of say, this is a bit odd, but it's got a backbone to it that I really like. Let's bulk it up and try it.
Yeah.
Experience will teach you what happens there.
Okay. I noticed that some of the wines we're going to taste later on today, some of them have been crossed in the last 30 years, really, isn't it? You're saying some were from the 1990s?
I mean, I look at them now and even, a lot of these ones from 1991.
Yeah.
91 was a very productive year for no other reason that a few freak occurrences took place. Don't know why that is. You can't duplicate it. But I mean, that's now a long time ago, 30 years. Since then, there have been many others. People have been breeding every year, so obviously there's a lot there. I've got 2,000 vines that I work through looking at how they're growing, how clean the leaves are. They never get sprayed. They've all, on paper, been tested for DNA markers and things. They should all be clean. They should all produce good fruit. Question for me is, when does that fruit ripen? And could I bulk it up and then get some into the UK to see how they grow in a cooler climate?
Mm. Okay, what I'll do, Stan, is I think we'll stop it there. I think we've got a good feel for why people do hybrids and how it's going.
Yeah.
Next week, I think what we'll do is we'll talk about some of the hybrids and some of the crossings and some of the more recent hybrids as well.
Yes,
sound good?
We can try that.